What's happening, guys? Welcome to the John Lovell Show. Today, I have a special guest, my favorite parenting author ever. If you were to ask me, and many people do, John, what should I be reading so that I could be a better dad or a mom? I would say you need to read John Roseman's book, specifically Parenting by the Book, but I have him as an exclusive interview today, and you're going to get to meet him, and I'm going to be able to ask questions. And by the end of this, not only are you going to pick up some incredible wisdom, maybe some family-altering, earth-shattering wisdom that's going to make your life as a parent way easier, your home's going to run smoother, more joy, more peace, more happiness, more disciplined kids, and it's actually probably easier than the beat that you're walking right now. You'll see why I love John Roseman, and you should too. Without further ado, we're starting the show. Here we go. What's happening, folks? Welcome back to the channel. I am hanging out with a man named John Roseman. He wrote this book, Parenting by the Book. We really based a lot of how we raised our kids off this. People who have read it really swear by it. This and a whole myriad of other books he's written are absolutely great. It's not the pop psychology child raising babble that's not working and building great amounts of self-esteem and ruining your children. This is stuff brass tacks. It really, really works exceptionally well. And we've got John Roseman on the line here for a special interview. So I'll be asking him all kinds of questions. Before so, let me give a quick bio for him. John Roseman has worked with families, children, and parents since 1971 in the field of psychology. He has appeared on numerous national television programs, including 2020, Good Morning America, The View, The Today Show, CNN, and CBS. And this was back in times where these weren't terrible propaganda outlets. These were actually good nationally respected programs at the time. And so that counts for something pretty great. Presently, his time is devoted to speaking and writing. He's syndicated in approximately 225 newspapers nationwide. He's written over 18 best-selling parenting books. He remains a licensed psychologist in North Carolina. And again, Parenting by the Book. Even while we're doing this, you can go buy it because it is amazing. John Roseman, thank you so much for being here with us. It's quite an honor.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, we are going to jump into some questions. The very first thing I wanted to know is I was reading in just preparation for this interview last night, and you talked about an old way of parenting versus a new way of parenting. So I'm a millennial. I'm certainly in the new way of parenting. It's not working. Lots of very bratty kids I see everywhere. Terrible behavioral problems. And even our parents, my parents were the boomers. They are also, I believe, in the new way of parenting. When you say old way, really you mean like my grandparents or their parents. So can you enlighten us with the difference between old parenting and new parenting as you meant it in your book?
Well, I'm a member of the last generation of American children who was raised the old way, the pre-psychological way. I was raised in the late 40s and early 1950s, or through the 1950s, if you will, depending on how you count it. The old way and the new way, the differences, the primary differences that in the traditional American family, the child was not the center of attention. Parents did not feel that their primary obligation was to pay attention to their children. People my age will tell you, John, that we received, especially relative to what we see going on today, we received very little attention. We were told very clearly that we were responsible for our behavior. We were told very clearly that there was no option to obedience. We were told very clearly that it was our job to pay attention to our parents. Today's parents, and especially today's mothers, are told by the media and by the peer group, which I call the Good Mommy Club, that their primary job is to pay as much attention to their children as they possibly can, which virtually guarantees that children do not learn how to pay attention to adults. When you are the object of attention, you do not learn to pay attention to the people who are giving you attention. It's just that simple. And by the time a child is 3 years old, he needs to have learned. It is the foundation of his continuing discipline, in fact, John. He needs to have learned that it's his job to pay attention to those people, not their job to pay attention to him. And, as I said before, I'm a member of the last generation of American children who, by the time we were 3 years old, which is the traditional end of the terrible twos, we understood that. We paid attention. We did what we were told. It's very interesting. I'm 76 years old. I don't remember yesterday very clearly, but I remember my childhood very clearly. And I can say with absolute confidence that as a child, I never saw another child throw a tantrum, ever.
Wow.
I never saw a child defy, resist, push back against a parental instruction or an instruction from any legitimate authority teacher. A responsible neighbor. I never saw a child push back. You know, when you were told to do something, you might have gone to, oh, do I have to do it now? And usually you were told, yeah, you have to do it now. And you went, okay, you did it. I mean, that was the extent of the flack that parents dealt with in the 1950s. And I was, until the pandemic, arguably the busiest parenting speaker in America. And I would tell my audiences, you know, you want the outcome that parents were getting in the 1950s. You want children who, by the time they're 3 years old, are obedient and not throwing tantrums when they don't get their way. Well, if you want that, you have to do that. You have to do what those parents are doing. The problem, John, and I guess it's the reason I'm on your show this morning, is that today's parents, the culture is not supporting parents who do what parents in the 1950s did. Hmm. For example, a mother who speaks to her child the way that a mother spoke to her child in the 1950s, which was in this very straightforward, authoritative way, this is what you're going to do, is looked upon by her peers in the Good Mommy Club as someone who shouldn't have had children in the first place. Hmm. Let me give you an example. I came home crying one time because the kids I was playing with were deliberately avoiding me when they passed the ball around, you know? And I don't know, I was 6 years old. And I come in crying because they won't share the ball with me. And my mother tells me very straightforwardly, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. I don't have time for this sort of foolishness. I remember this very clearly. It was like an epiphany in my life. You're making a mountain out of a molehill. I don't have time for this foolishness. Go back outside and solve your own problems. Where is the mother in America who talks that way to her child today?
Yeah.
You know, she's virtually not allowed to by her peer group.
Yeah, it looked like unloving child abuse. But you're saying, hey, when you turn all that attention to the child, fight their battles, solve their problems, pine over them, obsess over them, fuss over them, it's stunting them. They need to know the best thing you could do is have them solve their own problem. Is that fair? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, we know now that a quality called emotional resilience is the key to good mental health. And emotional resilience is all about accepting that in the real world, there is disappointment, there is loss, there is failure, there is all those things. Yeah. And that if you're going to be happy, you're not going to be happy because people try to make you happy.
Right.
You're going to be happy because you accept that in the world, there are going to be negative events that impinge upon your life, and you need to learn how to deal with these things without collapsing under their weight.
Mm, that's good. So as a dad, I am just built differently than my wife, obviously. She's just got this glorious nurturer trait. I'm nurturer, but I minor on what she majors on. And for my part, you know, kid gets knocked down or takes a loss in a soccer game or something, I want to protect him. No. Let him sit in it. It's okay if he hates losing, but he's got to work this stuff out. But I want him to go through that. It's kind of a natural default setting for a man to be like, no. Let him take the pain. However, I think moms struggle with that a lot more, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they struggle with it a lot. I mean, my mother didn't struggle with it.
Is it because your dad was the leader and your mother followed?
My mother was a single parent for most of the first 7 years of my life. Wow. I would say my formative years.
Wow.
Okay. You know, my mother was the only authority figure in the home.
Wow.
And no, my mother wasn't like that, John. My mother, she had, you know, she was a depression child. Wow. And that experience, growing up wanting, growing up deprived, growing up wondering in many cases where your next meal was coming from,
right,
had shaped her life very significantly. And it had shaped her approach to my upbringing in a very significant way as well. She understood, you know, her job was not to solve all of my problems. That's what today's mother believes. Today's mother believes the good mommy anticipates her child's problems, solves her child's problems. My mother didn't feel that way. My mother felt that I needed to learn how to solve my own problems. And so when I encountered a problem, my mother would simply talk to me very, very straightforwardly and say, "This is what the world is all about. You need to learn how to solve that problem."
Wow. Yeah.
I came home one time. I was in the fifth grade, and I told my mother that one of my fifth grade teachers, I was changing classes at that point, and I told her that one of my fifth grade teachers didn't like me. And my mother, without skipping a beat, you know, she didn't go into why do you think he doesn't like you and what he, you know, what's happening, you know, all the details. She just said, "Well, it's time for you to learn that you are going to encounter for the rest of your life people who don't like you. You're going to encounter teachers. You're going to encounter bosses. You're going to encounter coworkers. You're going to encounter neighbors. You're going to encounter people throughout your life who don't like you. And you need to learn how to deal with people who don't like you."
Wow.
"And I cannot do this job for you. You're going to have to do it yourself." So, you know, I talk to people my age, John, and this is the kind of experience nearly all of us had as we were growing up when we brought these sorts of complaints to our parents, mothers or fathers. Mothers and fathers were fairly aligned back in the 1950s. I mean, I was never aware that after my mother remarried that she and my stepfather had any significant differences concerning their approach to me. You know, and I talk to people my age and I ask them, during your upbringing years, were your parents on the same page? Oh, yeah, my parents were on the same page. I'll tell you why today's parents are not on the same page. Today's parents are not on the same page because, and this is almost counterintuitive, it's paradoxical. Today's parents are not on the same page because they believe that their fundamental primary roles in their families, once they have children, are the roles of mom and dad. And you can't get on the same page if you occupy the roles of mom and dad. The only way you get on the same page is to occupy the roles of husband and wife, primarily. And understand, mom and dad are secondary roles. They're roles you occupy part-time. But that is not what today's parents understand.
All right, so you've talked a good bit about moms. What about us dads? What are you seeing with modern fathers? Where are we falling short?
Well, returning to that same theme, and I'll return to it anecdotally. I was talking to my eldest grandchild. He's 28 years old, and he was he and his fiance were visiting with us, and he was talking, and he said, "When we have children, I want to be a great dad. I want to be the greatest dad I can possibly be." And I looked at him and I said, that's not your job, to be the greatest dad you can possibly be. When you're married, your job is to be the greatest husband you can possibly be. And he looked at me rather, you know, like he'd never even considered the concept. And I said, let me tell you what I eventually told him. I said, today's young people, they have children and they begin acting as if they took a vow on their wedding day that said, I take you to be my husband or I take you to be my wife until children do us part. Because
so good.
The marriage gets lost in what I call the parenting tango, you know, that just, it's a 24/7 tango.
I think people might hear what you said and be like, well, yeah, obviously I want to be the best husband and the best dad, but practically speaking, you can really only, you only have enough margin, enough time, enough energy to have a certain amount of focuses. And you're saying, no, spend more time pursuing your wife at the expense of pining at your kids and in making the, you know, your life more about your spouse. The kids don't become little Napoleon centers of attention, and they're going to prosper better with less attention. Is that a good kind of summation there, making sure I'm following you?
Yeah, more or less, John. What I maintain is that if you keep it straight, that you are husband first, father second, you will be the best father you are capable of being. Again, there's this counterintuitive paradox here. If you try to be the world's greatest dad, you're going to neglect your marriage. And your marriage is your number one priority as a male in your family, well, as a female as well. And if you're thinking and your behavior is in line with the fact that your number one priority is the priority of being a good husband, then you will be the best father you can possibly be. But it doesn't work in reverse.
Got it. So lots of date nights. You know, me and my old lady can do that. That sounds fantastic.
Well, you know, that raises an interesting point as well. Everybody thinks this about date nights. No, it's not about date nights. I mean,
hey, date night. Don't kick date nights too bad, man. Our date nights are awesome. I I know you're talking more about the day in and day out, but date nights are a neat cherry on top, and we really like them. So don't attack too much, but go ahead.
Yeah. Great. I understand that. You know, date nights are can be wonderful, should be. But this is not about one night a week. Right. This is about 24/7, 365, you know. And, you know, like you said earlier, this really requires a 180-degree paradigm shift in your thinking.
I love it.
You know, why am I here? I am here to be this woman's partner, life partner. My purpose in being here is not to be in relationship with these children.
Shifting back to the kids of ADD, ADHD, some type of behavioral defiance disorder. You've got kids that just have horrible behavioral problems. They throw tantrums and fits, and beleaguered parents, last straw, don't know what else to do. And some doctor prescribes some type of Adderall or Ritalin or something that kind of dopes them up so that they can behave better. What role do you think medication should have for the behavioral problems that I just mentioned, if any?
Well, John, good question. The first thing our listeners need to know is that there's no scientific or medical validity to any of these psychological diagnoses. They are concepts. They are not realities. Diabetes is a reality. ADHD is not a reality. It's a concept. The use of medication to deal with the behavior problems that are associated with these diagnoses is a form of cultural denial. We are in a state of denial as a culture. And the denial consists of the idea that these problems are not our doing. Well, they couldn't be, because I'm trying to be the best dad I can possibly be. I'm trying to be the best mom I can possibly be. These problems could not be of my doing. They have to be the result of something else. And so the medical psychological community has come up with this completely unsubstantiated fiction that these problems are due to biochemical imbalances and brain differences and things like that, black boxes inside the child's head that no one has ever verified exist. But because the explanation absolves us of responsibility for these problems, we accept the explanation, even though when you begin to look at it from a scientific point of view, these explanations are scientifically absurd. You give a kid medication for these behavior problems, and what do you get? Sometimes you get improved behavior. Sometimes you don't. Most people don't know that these medications, without exception, have never outperformed placebos, reliably outperformed placebos in clinical trials. And so, like a placebo, yes, there are times when these medications appear to work, but they're really not working. What they're doing is masking a much greater problem that exists in our society. Okay, so I said earlier, let me tell you another story. My first grade class consisted of 50 children.
Wow.
50. One teacher, she had no aid. I guarantee you she had fewer problems in a year than today's first grade teacher is having in the first week of school, with half that number of children and one or two aides. Why, how do you explain that? The only way to explain it is we came to school with a different understanding of, partial explanation, a different understanding of female authority than today's children are coming to school with. You know, your teacher's grades, kindergarten through five, 90% of them are going to be female, statistically. Your, as a child, your understanding based on your experience with female authority is going to impact your classroom behavior at a very significant level.
Right.
Well, I came to first grade understanding when a woman said, this is what you do, that is what you did. Today's kids come to first grade with the understanding that a woman is there to solve their problems and do things for them and make them happy. You can't raise children in two entirely different ways and arrive at the same outcome.
What is your thought on sending kids off to any type of government school now? Of the government schools you went to when you were a kid are not what is available now. If you were raising young ones in this 2024 climate, all right, what would their schooling process look like? Schooling is not the same as education.
There is no doubt about it, John. I would not send my children to public school today. Public schools are ideological factories. Their whole approach to education is not the sort of approach that I experienced. Their approach to education today is based on DEI philosophy. There is even now a movement, believe it or not, this is true, there is even a movement now to, it's called equitable math. The theory behind this movement is that insisting upon correct answers to math problems, like 2 + 2 = 4, is a form of white supremacy, racism. And therefore, with underprivileged minority children, we must not teach them correct answers. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Is the government okay with me reinterpreting how arithmetic works when I pay my taxes, just so we can stay consistent?
Question.
I just want to be consistent. Well, so if Big Brother is saying 2 + 2 = 4, I want to redo my taxes.
Yeah, I mean, the logic of that is impeccable, as a matter of fact, John. The problem is that you're a white man. And so, you know,
but I identify as a short Asian LGBTQer. So,
well, you could, yes. And perhaps, you know, that would be an argument that would fly not in front of today's Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court that's probably to come, you know, next.
Yeah. Daily rhythm of kids. Okay. We did some schooling time. And now just day in, day out rhythms, chores. How hard should you be working kids? What kind of extracurricular activities should and shouldn't they be doing? One frustration my wife and I have had is we do our schooling. We were homeschoolers the whole time. And so a lot of kids are going off to the factory and then we wait for them to get home. But then they have extracurricular activities, they have sports, and then they just never go outside. They're just married to screens. And so we've had over a dozen addresses in our marriage, every time we move somewhere, kids just don't go outside. And I'm like, that can't be good. Where are we? What should the daily rhythms of a kid's life be, and chores and play and activities and friends?
You know, children should be allowed to invent their own games, manage their own games. They should run their own play. One huge difference between the upbringing of children pre-1970 and the upbringing of children today is exactly what you just described. And it's something that people my age, you know, we notice, we bemoan concerning our grandchildren. We don't see our grandchildren having the same childhood experience we did. Our childhood experience was, let's take a typical Saturday. You wake up in the morning, you do your bedroom chores, make your bed, you know, straighten things up, put your night clothes away. get dressed, go downstairs, have breakfast, and go outside.
Right.
And you you found other kids, and you decided what you were going to do. Hey, let's play baseball. And so we all went home and we got our baseball mitts and our balls and our bats. And, you know, we gathered at a certain empty lot or wherever we could play baseball. And we played baseball. And there were no adults telling us what positions to play, how to throw the ball, how to hit the ball. You know, we taught each other. Hmm. And it was a marvelous experience. And it's one of the things that has become lost over the last 50 years or so is just the freedom that children used to experience. Today's kids are micromanaged from time they wake up in the morning until they go to sleep at night.
I fear we're not working them hard enough, too. Of what type of chore and work output should we do with kids? And immediately, just the coddling nature of raising kids today, it feels like to work them, even for a few minutes, might be unloving. Hit us with some general ideas of, no. What's loving is to teach them work ethic. It's to keep them from being spoiled. You need to work them at least like this for this long each day. Give us some general handholds, if you would.
Well, these adult-organized, adult-managed, adult-run youth sports are in 99.9% of the cases involved here, they're going to have no relevance to anything these kids are doing when these kids are 30 years old. No relevance at all. But the fact that you are expected in your home to be a functional, contributing member of your family, not a freeloader, but a member, that you contribute to the maintenance of the family to the degree that you are capable of doing so, is going to have tremendous relevance to your life when you are 30 years old. So I think the answer to your question, from my point of view, John, is very obvious that, you know, children ought to be doing chores in the home, and they ought to be doing chores from the time they're 3 years old. My own experience, 3.5 years old, my mother, single parent at the time, had taught me how to wash floors. So we didn't have wall-to-wall carpeting. We lived in what is called a cold water flat. In the cheapest place you could live in Charleston, South Carolina at the time, which is now called the Historic District, where you can't buy a home for less than, you know, $5 million. We didn't have hot running water. And my mother taught me when I was 3 years old to wash floors. My mother taught me when I was 4 years old to wash my own clothes in her washing machine, which was a galvanized tub that sat on the side porch with hand rollers bolted to it. You know, I grew up with no money until I was, you know, probably a teenager. And my mother and stepfather finally arrived at a point in life where they could afford something besides the bare essentials. You know, I had no money. There was nothing, you know, when I walked into a store with my parents, there was no thought in my mind that I was going to get something. You know, I wasn't going to get some treat. I wasn't going to get a toy. Well, I look back on that and man, I wouldn't change that experience for anything in the world.
A last question I had for you. I want to be real respectful of your time. So gracious to join us once again. Thank you. Let's say,
hey, John, thank you. I appreciate it, man. And I'm here for you, you know.
Well, you're helping a lot of people, so thank you. Let's say somebody just haven't knocked it out of the park raising kids thus far. And right now, some folks tuning in have some teenagers that are just real tough to handle. They've kind of disconnected. Mom and dad are idiots. They're plugged into their own tech and their own friends. And they just seem to be at war with themselves and with their family. And so you've got a teenager, 15, 16 years old, that is really going downhill and is disconnected. What would you coach parents in that situation? Not with little kids now, but with teenagers that have a foot out the door.
The first question I would ask these parents, if I was to be coaching them, would be, are you willing to make your child extremely unhappy? Because the only way to turn this situation around with a teenager is to make the teenager extremely unhappy with you. And are you willing to do that? And, when I do ask that question, when I'm sitting with parents and talking about an out-of-control teenager, most of the time they say, oh, yeah, we're willing to do that. But when it comes down to the rubber meeting the road, John, they're really not.
So what would that actually look like? You know, of like, hey, come down here right now, young lady. No, I'm staying in my room. What does that look like? Of they're already unhappy. They're already miserable. So functionally, what's that look like?
It would look like taking away all electronics. It would look like taking away a driver's license, taking away driving privileges, stripping the child's life down to army barracks. And, explaining to the child, it doesn't give me pleasure to do this, but the fact of the matter is, it's my job to send you out into the world as a functional citizen.
Got it.
And this is your training ground. And I've obviously done a very bad job of preparing you for real world contingencies. And in order to help you understand what you will need to understand in order to function as a responsible citizen, I've got to do some things I don't want to do.
So let's war game this out. I have taken all electronics and, hey, you're grounded and he or she hates me and locked themselves in their room for 2-3 days, won't look at me, won't talk to me. And mom here is starting to want a cave, starting to want a peacemaker of like, how does this start to gain resolution? Where do we see fruit? Where do we go a few days into much worse?
Well, you've got to get yourselves on the same page before you start something like this. Mm-hmm. You can't muddle your way through it, John. This is, and I have recommended this sort of approach before. I've been working with parents for, nearly 50 years. Wow. And there isn't a story I haven't heard. And I have recommended that approach. And I have tried to coach parents through it, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. What you have to have a game plan clearly in place before you start an intervention of this sort, the sort that we're discussing here. You can't muddle your way through it. And you've got to make sure that you cover all the contingencies. Okay, so he screams, he hates me. What is my response? Well, my response is, well, I understand. If I was your age and dealing with circumstances that you are currently dealing with, I would hate me too. It's okay. It's all right. The thing that parents do these days, John, is they engage with their children. You know, I ask parents, why are you engaging with your child? A mother the other day, she tells me that her six-year-old tells her, you're not the boss of me. I don't have to do what you tell me to do. He's 6 years old. And I said, so what is your response to that? And she says, I tell him, yes, I am the boss of you. And yes, you do have to do what I tell you to do. And I say, no, no, no. That is not the way to do it. The way to be an authority figure is to render in your response what the child has said irrelevant. Render it as irrelevant. How do you do that? You look at the kid and go, well, I understand. I understand where you're coming from. And if I was your age right now, yeah, I'd be thinking the same thing, man. And you just turn around and walk away. Mm. But today's parents, they get into these situations and their attitude is, I've got to win. And when that's your attitude, you've lost.
Wow.
You've lost.
How about that? Well, any final closing remarks you'd like to tell to our audience? We're mostly dudes, 30s and 40s. So lots of guys tuning in with young kids and teens and everything in between.
Hands down, Led Zeppelin was the greatest rock and roll band that's ever been.
That's an objective fact. You're saying it's not open for interpretation. You are the authority on this?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay.
Most people don't know, by the way, John, that I was the lead singer in a working rock and roll band for 7 years. I even supported my family playing rock and roll.
Really? So you are truly a parenting rock star.
Yeah. We were a rock and roll band. We did not do parenting ballads. But anyway, my final words of wisdom is... and I'll reiterate something I said earlier, the better a husband you are, the better a father you will be. It does not work the other way around.
I think that's a terrific place to end. Thank you so much. Again, I'm so privileged that you would jump through the hoops to brave all the technological loops that you didn't know how to do prior to this video interview. And so, man, really, impressed, ourselves on you, and thank you for being gracious with us.
John, the technological education was invaluable. Thank you.
Well, I'm just trying to give back, sir. Where can folks find you? Where can they check out your books?
I have two websites. We're doing a lot of work on them. So if you go to them and they're down, just take a deep breath, wait a few hours and go back. But the two websites are parentguru.com, parentguru, and johnrosemond.com.
Okay, we'll check it out. Thanks so much for hanging out with us, sir. And for all you guys tuning in, we'll see you next time. All right, guys, hopefully you enjoyed John Rosemond. If not, it's probably because you live a dysfunctional life with terrible children that are running around like stray feral cats and a meth lab, and you're the problem. And I don't even know how you found this interview. I don't think those people are watching how to get better at parenting videos. Wow, this is quite...
You threw feral cats and meth labs together in the same sentence.
It really got away from me. You know?
But that's not you, good viewer. You are not that cut of
you're
people.
You're not that person. I know you. You're not that person.
Let's head into some hot topics.
All right, let's do some hot topics, then.
John, we're putting AI to good use, the best of use. I've got a great story for you. Black Baltimore High School athletics director is charged with using AI to create a fake racist rant he then blamed on the white principal. Here's the backstory. This is wild. Dazon Darian was accused of mishandling school funds when, in apparent retaliation for the probe that he was currently under, he allegedly generated a fake audio recording using AI of the school's principal, Eric Eiswirt, spewing racial and anti-Semitic insults about staff and students. And I listened to this thing, John. It's kind of like the audio is positioned as like someone has a camera and it's like in the distance. It sounded 100% real.
Wow. So it's somebody pretending to say terrible racist kind of things.
Yes.
But it's a deep fake. So, yeah, okay, all right.
Yes.
So here's the problem with our current cultural moment with systemic racism being this horrible, rampant, terrible national security problem. There's a supply-demand problem. We demand to have this terrible crisis that we keep hearing. There's systematic racism everywhere. It's the biggest threat to national security is white supremacy. And we're told that. Now, nobody sees that in America. I live in the heart of the South. I always have. I don't know where they're talking about this. Of like, I have no idea where this is happening. I think it's only happening on legacy media who's spinning this narrative. But what you're seeing here is they demand this horrible white supremacist problem. Of course, there's white supremacy and there's all kinds of stupid people doing racist stuff. But the whole point is it's a minority problem. It's not this huge systematic racist problem. It was amazing to me that we could put a black dude in the White House for 8 years and still say, nope, you can't get ahead if you're black in America. I'm like, you're the highest office in the land. Twice, 8 years. No one gives a rip anymore. Just leave us shut up about the race baiting. You guys are terrible. And they're trying to make a false artificial crisis, put us against each other so we won't see the sleight of hand that's happening, which is our leaders are seizing massive swaths of power and money. The idea, the Marxist plan is always divide and conquer, get us fighting with each other. And so they demand awful racism problems so that they can come in and affect cultural change, their globalist agenda. But there's just not a lot of racist supply out there to meet the demand. So here, this next wave, this shocks me zero. This is absolutely shocks me zero. They're always on a witch hunt and there's no witches. Now, we're America, so it's like pagan occult. We got witches all over the place, but you get the metaphor, right?
Yeah, there's one man that AI will never be able to replicate, in my opinion, and it is the John Lovell. AI would never be able to deepfake you. It would lack the soul. It would lack the passion. There's not enough CPU power.
You can't fake this beard.
No.
Can't do it.
No.
Can't do it.
No, the audio would sound terrible. You're the only person I think that could never be duped.
That is absolutely untrue. Somebody watching them like, dude, whatever. Hold my macchiato. I'll do this right now. And they just totally deepfake me of like, I think AI is incredibly sophisticated. The problem is AI, I was thinking about this a couple of days ago. I wanted to show my boys the movie 300. And there's some really inappropriate scenes in there. And actually, maybe most of the movie's inappropriate. And I don't mind my boys seeing some cool combat scenes and some death.
Violence.
I don't mind as much about the violence. The sex scenes, I really have a problem with. That's the biggest one. Nudity, I have a problem with. Some bad language and some of the real gratuitous violence, because that of like cutting heads off and some of the more grisly dark stuff. I want to see some of the blood and gore, but not all the blood and gore for my boys. And so what I surmised is the movie is just too bad for my kids, you know, of like they're years out from being able to watch this. And I mean, there's stuff in 300 that I don't want to see as a grown man. I'm not old enough to see it. I'll never be old enough to see it. You should never see certain stuff. And I wish we were using AI to be able to filter that out. I was looking through the app store on my TV and I'm trying to find out what is something that can filter this stuff out, because AI could absolutely filter out nudity and bad language and all this. It'd be an easy thing, but there's no demand for it.
Dude, that's great. Hey, do you remember back in the 90s, you had those popular movies, but then they made them for TV and basically they made them like TV-ish. And so they cut out the swearing.
Yeah.
They cut out. That's what I am looking forward to. Like 300, if they had done like a 1990s, like, you know, version for TV that was like PG, they could totally do that. AI could help.
I think there is a solution. VidAngel, the app wasn't available on my TV. I couldn't download it.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe I'm misunderstanding the technology, but there is something that exists. But this stuff should be all over the place. I'm like, this is a great thing. But we only want to censor good things, and we don't want to censor bad things. So it's 2024, and everything's super demonic and evil. It's awful.
That's
horrible, horrible world we live in.
Hey, the world I want to live in is a world where John Lovell water skis. Have you ever water skied?
Yeah, absolutely.
When was the last time you water skied?
It's been a while, but I've been slalom skiing since I was like 8 years old. I'm like, I can ski.
Well, apparently you could have water skied in Dubai a few weeks back because Dubai was underwater. Did you catch that news story? Mm-mm. Dubai got 2 years worth of rain in a single day.
Wow.
In a single day. So there's some footage. Go ahead and check that footage.
Just 24 hours. According to the meteorological department, it rained up to 259.5 millimeters or some 10 inches.
Travel chaos continues to cause delays at the Dubai International Airport, the world's second busiest airport.
There's a scene of airplanes on the runway taxiing. They're underwater.
Dude.
Wow,
where did all this come from? What, I mean.
Yeah, so the thing that the reason I bring this up is that some were saying that this might have been due to cloud seeding. And regrettably, it probably was not due to cloud seeding. That's a technology that's been around since the 40s. Basically, what we do is we spray a silver iodide into clouds, and it binds and it makes things rain. And I wanted to believe that that was our foolishness is what caused Dubai to go underwater. But regrettably, it was not.
What was it? I mean, 2 years.
Yeah, it was really just a crazy conflux of meteorological events that just came together in the right way, the right time over several countries to do that. So I think they've been tracking their rainfall since the 40s. They've never experienced anything like this.
Everything is so weird in the world right now. I mean, whether it's geological or biological, mostly sociological, politically, yeah. all everything that could be just weird and shocking and awful. All of it's just playing constantly around.
And on that vibe, I have now left you forever with the weird and shocking image of John Lovell water skiing in your mind.
It's not. I'm water skiing's fun. I'm pretty good at it. Now, snow skiing, that's hard. Because if all you knew was water skiing, on water skiing, especially if you're slalom skiing, you got to pull way hard back against the boat. You're leaning back. And so fast forward, one day I tried to snowboard or snow ski, you're supposed to lean forward. And I'm like, okay, this is weird. And you lean forward and I'm like, all right, it's working. But the moment I would go to turn or do anything, I would fall back into my old habits of, I have skis, lean back. And then I would lean back and wipe out. And so, water skiing and snow skiing. You think of like, oh, you do one, you do the other. I'm like, no, one hurts the other. It makes it worse. So there's the things about skis.
Hey, the last hot topic I got for you is going to start with a question. And the question is, John, how many 10-round magazines do you own?
I own a lot of 10-round magazines. But they're really? All for my War Poet CR920.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're 10-round magazines for my subcompact War Poet, which is what I'm carrying most of the time now. And then sometimes I have a CR920P, so that's the comped version of the subcompact. I'm carrying that a lot, too, but that's with the 13-rounder. And so,
the reason I mention is because the National Shooting Sport Federation released a report recently that was really interesting. It had to do with magazines. So here's some really, really good numbers. Americans apparently own over 700 million magazines with the capacity over 10 rounds. So that's 700 million magazines with a capacity over 10 rounds. And of those 700 million, about 50% of those magazines are rifle magazines with that 30 plus capacity.
Yeah.
So basically, because being in the industry that we are, we'll often hear that, you know, these magazines are not necessary. They're not usable.
Necessary for what?
For hunting deer, according to Joe Biden or whatever.
Well, yeah, but that's not why I have them. And I don't need to justify anything regarding firearms because you can't touch it. It's the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, but it's a tyranny-proof system, meaning no. You can have 40 or 50, and you don't even have to tell the government of, like, you don't need it. I'm like, I do need it. If the government tells you you don't need it, you need it.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't say anything, then you get it if you want it. You know, just it's Second Amendment, baby. And so you do whatever you want. And if I want a whole war chest of 30-round magazines for my AR-15, well, those are standard issue magazines. It's not high cap. It's standard.
And so that's what I'm going to have. I'm going to have a lot. And just because I'm hearing about this, I think I'm going to go buy a whole bunch of 30-round magazines today. And because when I hear these awful news, like it's kind of like my revenge buy. I'm like, I'm going to buy a 30-round magazine. Screw that. I'm going to do the thing because American. I'm going to live as free as I can for as long as I can in an age where freedom is disappearing. And I think that's the ultimate flex back. That's what we do. Whatever they say you can't say, say it loud. If they say you no, and they censor you, say it even louder. I think it's the only way that we can keep free. That's it. Is resist and refuse to be bullied, refuse to be silenced, refuse to give up freedoms. And instead, not only do you refuse to give it up, you go ahead and exercise it right then and there. So it's become a reflex to me. You can't do that. You can't go buy a whole bunch every time. You're just going to go completely broke. And now in saying, you know, one type of freedom, you lose all financial freedom. And so maybe just get a couple mags today, but you get the sentiment, right?
Yep. And I mean, statistically speaking, you are correct. The 30 plus round magazine is the standard magazine in America, according to the stats. So that's great news. All right, John, that's it for Hot Topics. Let's dive into some Q and Ambush. All right. Question one comes from Carter. Carter wants to get a gun. He says, new fan here, stumbled across WPS recently, and it's some of my favorite stuff to watch and listen to. So, hey, man, thanks for that. He continues, I'm from Alabama and a first-year law student at the University of Arizona. I've been thinking the past few months about buying a handgun for protection because of the break-ins and car windows that are getting smashed at my apartment complex. My family has never owned a firearm, and I wonder how they'll react. My question is, do you have any tips for showing them the light? Benefits, reasons why having a firearm would be a good move for me?
Well, hey, welcome to Warrior Post Society. So thrilled that you are going to take steps to be able to defend yourself and other people around. That makes you a force for good in the world. So way to go. Love that. Now, if you have reason to believe that your family is just going to hit the roof, I don't know what family you come from, but if you suspect this isn't going to go over well, you could lovingly, because this is why we do it, lovingly kind of loosen them up for it. And so all you have to do is kind of send articles and some reports. Anytime that comes across your desk, you can fire it over to your parents so that they're seeing, oh, wow, there's a need. Oh, there's a need. Oh, this is unsafe. This is unsafe. And so then one day you can just casually be like, you know what, just in case, I went ahead and got a firearm, you know, and I haven't done much with it. It just, you know, there, just in case an emergency. And this is a way that you could kind of break them in slowly to it. Why I'm interested in this rather than just the flex, because some people out there want to flex on them. They'd be like, I bought it. It's mine. I got my Second Amendment and I'm doing my thing and you should get them too. And your family just all of a sudden, that sudden of a shock, that's not being a good Second Amendment advocate in the sense of I want to convert them to think like I do. I don't want to just make a point, which you would be valid in making. You can say the Second Amendment thing. I'm like, no, I have the right. I want to do it. So suck it up, mom and dad. I'm doing what I want. I'm a man. And that's true. You could do that. But I want to win them to my cause. And so I find it a little bit better to do that a little slower. It's a kinder way to do it. So if you want to do it that way, that's probably wise.
All right, let's move into question number two. It comes from Dawson. He says, hey, John, been watching your YouTube since 2017 with the war story videos. I'm a big reader and passionate about Texas and American history. My friends tell me I should be a history teacher, but I'm concerned with working for the public school system, and I personally believe homeschooling today is the better thing. My question is, should I pursue public school history teaching and try to make a difference, or would it be better to stay away from that career and find something else to do with my passion for history?
Well, awesome. Glad that you love history. That is fantastic. I think it's one of the most important subjects you can possibly study. So way to go. I am against having your children sent to the government to raise. So government schools, I think that's dangerous. I think that's a bad idea for even more reasons than just the sick perversion being taught, drag shows and critical race theory. It's really more postmodern culture. And it's that nothing kills the imagination creativity and love of learning and reading specifically like a government school. That's the worst thing. That's the terrible, terrible thing. Government schools are designed to crush the spirit of your kids and destroy their love of learning, especially your sons. It's going to be so bad that most of you will have to medicate your kids just so that they can get through the normal droll of government schools. It's really, really, really bad for your kids in ways that you're probably not realizing. Now, for educators or principals, I would love the idea of you guys going and working in government schools. Yeah, let's redeem that institution of power of like, you guys are trained up. Go ahead, go in behind enemy lines to this institution of power, which has been hijacked, and see if you can't rescue some other kids. That's wonderful. Now, if you are one of us, if you're a patriot, if you're a freedom lover, if you refuse to self-censor and you care about what's happening to these kids, most government school cultures will find you out and push you out. So I don't know how long you're going to be able to speak the truth and stay there because it's a overrun institution. Now, not all places. Some places in rural America or the Midwest and all kinds of places like that, the school is maybe 20 years behind what's happening now. And you could say, well, what's happening here in these woke schools? That's not happening here. I'm like, yep, you're right. You don't have drag shows and story hours like that. They're not teaching CRT. True, true. But they're still destroying the imagination, creativity, and love of learning of your kids. And they're teaching boys in a way that is the worst possible way to teach boys. Boys don't learn like little girls do. And you put them in classroom and it's the constant year after year droll and drudgery. It destroys the spirit of your kids. Slowly, year after year, the light goes out in your kids' eyes and they lose ambition. They lose their sense of awe. Their spirits break slowly and surely. You don't have to agree. This is what I really believe, and we can agree to disagree. But for you wanting to go and rescue kids behind enemy lines in government schools, I applaud you. I think that's awesome. I think we need good people to do that. But I think that your kids should be in some type of homeschool or a homeschool co-op or a really effective private school. A lot of times private schools are just government schools in terms of curriculum and programming. They just add a code of conduct and a chapel and you have to pay a lot more to it. So what I've observed is a lot of private schools, most of them are functionally very similar to a government school. So beware.
Mike's got a question for you, and he is wrestling with introverted disorder. He says, hey, John, I'm a very introverted Christian man who likes time to myself to gather thoughts and think over daily issues. I enjoy a quiet, organized, and clean home where everything is either scheduled ahead of time or part of a daily routine. My wife and kids, on the other hand, are rowdy, messy, fly by night, and sporadic with everything. Lately, I just feel so mentally defeated and can't seem to unwind when I get home from work to a house that's a complete wreck and surprise evening events scheduled. I absolutely love my wife and kids and would do anything for them, but lately I dread coming home from work. What's a warrior poet to do?
Wow. Mike, thank you for your question. I think it's a really good one. One thing you definitely shouldn't do is just suck it up, swallow it, and deal with it. I think you have a real felt need. You're going out, you're working daily, you're coming home exhausted, and you need a sanctuary and a place of rest, and you're frankly not getting it. The very first thing you need to do is pick a good moment where you can talk to your spouse about your real concerns. I mean, literally, take the question that you just submitted to me and read it to your wife. Now, timing is really critical on this. I mean, she's cooking dinner and the kids are driving her crazy and she's harried and everything's kind of up in the air and you spring this on her, it's going to be a fight. And so really of like, hey, baby, I got something on my chest. I'm worried about how you'll react. It's nothing real bad or anything. I just, man, I'm struggling here and I really need your ear. Can you tell me when a good time would be for this? And we'll be able to just sit down. It won't take long, and it's probably worse than whatever you're thinking. So nothing earth-shattering and shocking. I'm having trouble resting, and I need you to weigh in. And I would do that. And so you got to pick the good time and place to be able to spring this, because what you want is her allied with you shoulder to shoulder and not defensive. If it's defensive, now you're in a fight. Now, truth be told, given the stark difference, and you're talking about the entire rhythm of life and lifestyle, it's probably going to be a fight. Don't get upset. Don't engage. Just say like, hey, I'm sorry. This is how I feel. I wish I didn't have this need, but I do. And I don't know how to change. Maybe all you're saying is right, baby, but I am where I am. I wish I didn't need what I need, but I do. And I was wondering if there's just maybe a couple small things that we could do that didn't swing the pendulum way over to what I'm thinking, but maybe just a little bit that allowed me to be able to rest. And then you go ahead and give that proposal. I'm like, I propose that our children should do far more chores, and I am committed to helping ensure that they do that. So when I come home, if the house is in at least these few rooms of like the kids' room, maybe that's just chaos, but the living room, my room, the kitchen area, pick a few rooms and say, these areas need to be cleaned up by the time I get home. So if they're not, the kids, one, have to scramble to go ahead and, kids, clean it all up. You've disobeyed me here. And now there needs to be an immediate consequence. And that consequence should be pretty terrible in that it should take away some free time that they really valued. If they have some toy or some activity that they really valued, now they don't get that. And so make the cost of disobedience high and put it all on the kids. Probably your wife is already doing a great amount of stuff. So what you don't want to do, you're tired, she's tired, is put a bunch more on her plate. Put it on the kids. They don't have jobs. And they're the ones making all the mess. They're the ones causing all the stress. If it was just you and your wife, it'd probably be pretty easy to keep some semblance of clean and ordered. It's the kids that are the agents of chaos. And what you have is kids that are not as disciplined in the ways that you need them to be. So the kids are both probably most of the problem. They'll also be most of the solution. Make your kids clean your house every single day before you arrive home. And that right there would be wonderful, wonderful steps right there to being able to bounce back as a man. This is such a good question. I'm going to keep going. When I get home, especially on a Monday, today's a Monday. Mondays are my hardest day. When I come home, I'm usually pretty whipped. And the whole family knows daddy is tired. And so nobody asks me to do anything, see anything, answer any questions for anything for like 20, 30 minutes. I kiss my wife. I hug my children. I go put my bag down in my room. I close the door and I just space out 20, 30 minutes. And I find that transition time so important, so critical. Then I can come out of my room or wherever I was. Maybe I go on a walk or something. Then I come back and man, that transition time, I mean, I got a second wind. Now I'm ready to engage the family and I got something now to offer so that I can be able to coordinate. Now, most days, I don't even need that big transition time. My home is a place of peace and rest. It is a sanctuary. I had to fight to get it that way over the years. I am more clean and ordered. My wife is a little bit more of a left brain creative type. And as such, the creative types, they're okay with, disorganized book tables. There's never a place to put anything down because all the flat spaces of your house are filled with junk. And not junk, but she would be more like that. Like if you go and see in our bathroom, my side of the sink, there is nothing out. Zero things. It's just a sink. And everything else is well ordered in drawers. Then her side is the opposite.
Pandora's box.
It's the opposite. And so anyway, we both live differently. Now, in my marriage, I've made steps so that the OCD orderliness of my life is not fully realized. I would like everything clean and organized all the time. And that's just not really realistic for bringing up kids and having a healthy home, especially if your wife isn't wired that way as well. So she has made decisions slowly over time to come a little bit more toward an organized household. Our living room is almost always organized and clean. I need that space. the dining room as well, and the kitchen, except the dishes in the sink. Dishes may or may not be overflowing or whatnot, but those three rooms are relatively organized. The kids upstairs, our guest room, our homeschool space. I mean, who knows what kind of state that is. But if it's messy and I'm irritated by it, I'm like, boys, come in. Clean all this up. Let's go right now. And they can't move on and go back to what they were doing until it's all done. And so they recognize I've got discipline, I've got good standards, and the moment that y'all obey, and the faster you obey, the more you can go and play and do whatever you want to do. So that is really, really critical. Now, she's had to make steps toward adapting to my desire for orderliness so that I can rest, and I've had to come off my extremely rigid way that I liked organization as a bachelor. I mean, my socks were all rolled into perfect canoes and organized in my sock drawer as such. So if you'd pulled it out, you would have seen rows of perfectly organized canoe socks. And I don't do that anymore. I don't do it even close. She does my laundry as well. And so it's just kind of, this is how they are now. And so I'm good with it. It's still organized. It's not like I wanted. But I don't need that anymore. I have come toward her. She has come toward me. And we figured out a lifestyle that actually works for both of us. And we're very happy in it. You're going to have to do that as well.
All right. Our final question for today comes from Joseph. And he wonders about that hard to comprehend constitutional writing. So he says, not so much a question as a suggestion. You guys should do a show explaining and breaking down the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. I can't be the only one that finds the language difficult to understand. So what do you think about that? Do we have anything on the network?
Right? Absolutely. The Tavern with Rick Green.
That's what I was thinking.
That's what he's primarily doing. So on WPSN, I mean, here we have the Tavern. Check out Rick Green's stuff. They're always having these kind of conversations. Now, they're also talking about other ancillary topics, but really the core of it is understanding founders' intent, constitutional documents, and extrapolating that into the present so that we can remain a constitutional republic. And so he is unpacking that, very, very good at it. Check out the Tavern. It's fun, too. So thank you for your suggestion. We will accept your suggestion months ago. When we started that show, right? No, but I hear that. I think that's a fantastic suggestion and point. I just think we're accomplishing that. Maybe not in the form that you're thinking, but at least in a pretty good, and I think even more entertaining form. So there we go.
Guys, hey, thanks so much as always for sending in your questions. And if you would like to send us a question, you can send that to JLS@watchwpsn.com. That's JLS@watchwpsn.com. And John, that's all we got for today. So how about you send us off?
All right, guys. Thanks so much for tuning in. I thought there was some just gold in this one. I mean, what?
Yeah.
So much wisdom from John Roseman. I really like that last question that I dealt with as well of how do you integrate in? You're exhausted and the house is a mess. I wonder how many dudes out there have that exact same struggle and haven't really figured out what it is. And it's causing stress of like, man, if you can't rest, you keep getting more and more worn out and more burnout and more beleaguered.
That was a good one.
And I'm like, no, you must rest. You have to Sabbath. You have to rest. You got to be able to bounce back. And if you don't, man, you're going to, things are going to go really, really badly. You can white knuckle it for a while, but only for a while.
When a man's at the point where he says he is not excited about going home, that's where, you know, you got to make a decision.
Yeah. And he said, I dread going home. I'm like, man, that is not good. You've got things must change immediately.
Yeah.
And even a small change will feel wonderful. So, I think that's the ticket. Small changes over time work well in a marriage. Huge changes all of the sudden. It's probably not realistic and it puts extraordinary stress on your spouse, which makes even less rest, in your pursuit of some changes in rest, you explode your marriage with conflict that stretches on for weeks. I'm like, well, now you're going to add a fight to it all. And so that doesn't sound fun either. Guys, thanks so much for tuning into the John Lovell Show. We will see you next time. We're out.